Today is 4/18/83. Present time is 8:47. We do have three pieces of legislation for consideration this morning. Those members present are Representative Wente, Kopanen, Yuling, and Chairman Curtis. Is Terry Kramer here? Is she going to be here this morning?
No.
Let's work on HB 53, the first piece of legislation. Morning, John.
Morning.
Let the record show that Representative Cowdery is here. HB 53 is a legislation introduced by the Blue Ribbon Commission. It's an act prohibiting duplicate teacher retirement benefits for Alaska BIA services. You may recall there was a small loophole where an employee could feasibly partake of both programs. We did, we held hearings on this some time back, and I believe that one of the problems we did on the fiscal note. We do have that now. I think you may have a copy being passed down to you. What is the pleasure of the committee concerning this piece of legislation?
Yes, I think I'd like to make a motion to move it on out because I think it's a big concern.
Is that a motion or something?
Yes.
Time to open up this morning.
Well, my time is this way.
We do have a motion with a request for unanimous consent concerning House Bill 53. Are there any objections? Hearing none, so be it. Piece of legislation we should hear is HB 25.
Well, they ran D-League members in their permanent.
HB 25 is an act providing for preference and reservation and sale of purchase of state royalty oil to companies purchasing state coal. The prime sponsor is Representative Lindau this morning. We would ask Mr. Lindau to provide testimony at this time.
Very briefly, Mr. Chairman. This bill was drafted by Drafting Service as a way to increase economic development of the state without spending any money or in any way costing us any money. It merely, its intent is to give preference in the sale of our state royalty oil to companies that will purchase additional state coal. I can suggest a couple of words for a committee substitute, because after this came out and some discussion pointed out to me that it could be interpreted slightly differently than the intent that I gave the legislative drafter. The intent here is to allow a company to come in, and if there's one company that's going to buy state oil and pay us the market price, and another company that's going to buy state oil at the market price and will agree to buy coal, that we should, because we're trying to develop that industry, and we should give preference, other things equal, to the company that will buy coal. The intention of this bill, as I see it, is not to give a lower price for royalty oil, not to in any way reduce in anything. After the price is established, that he who will buy more of coal would otherwise get it. It's to piggyback or leverage the development of one industry with another. And therefore, in clause on line 12 and 13, I think instead of first offer, we should perhaps use the words give priority in the, so it's natural resources shall give priority in the sale of state oil to companies purchasing, and then where it says state coal, I'd put the word additional state coal, because I hate to have some company buy a small amount of state coal and then claim thereafter it's supposed to get a preference in all oil.
Let me see now, line 12, I would agree now, the Commission on Natural Resources
shall give priority in the sale of state crude oil to companies purchasing the largest amount of additional state coal. There are large industrial companies, particularly in the Far East, and also in the West Coast of the United States. Pacific Resources of Honolulu, for example, a big refiner in Honolulu, is also the utility company there. They are a buyer of coal and they are a buyer of crude oil. They, I know, came to Alaska and attempted to make a deal. Had they been able to get royalty oil, they would have bought coal. They could not get royalty oil, so they did not buy coal. They would have bought both, they bought neither. That was a very unfortunate set of circumstances for us, because it would have developed a whole new industry and provided jobs, particularly back 2 or 3 years ago when we had massive unemployment among the Teamsters and the railroad people. It was a good thing, and it was blowing because there was no time. And I again tell the committee, this is not to sell royalty oil cheap, not one penny less. It's just that if we're going to offer it to somebody, those who buy the most additional coal ought to get a priority over those who need it. Second thing, the second part of this bill, part G, starting line 14, has to do with the sale of state oil subject to the reservation of a state right to purchase defined products for offer to companies purchasing state coal. The words after state oil, there should be the words to in-state refiners. We already do that in part of our contracts.
Line 14.
In line 14, it says a contract for the sale of state oil is subject to the reservation. I think it should say a contract for the sale of state oil to in-state refiners is subject to the reservation. Although maybe we don't want to say that. I think that's something for the committee to think about. Right now, in some of our royalty oil contracts, the state reserves the right to take back the so-called residual. For example, when we sell oil on some of our contracts to Chevron and Tesoro, they make gasoline, which they sell in Alaska. The residual is sold out of state to power generation, for other refining, for other purposes. The state already is, in some contracts, holding that right to buy that residual. And due to a particular event that I know about, wherein a company offered to buy coal on the absolute condition, signed a contract to buy coal on the condition that the state would allow it to buy some of that residual that it was entitled to, and the Commissioner of Natural Resources explicitly agreed that he would provide that to encourage that industry. And I was there, and I personally heard him agree. And then when it turned out these people were really serious and they were going to buy this coal and put those people to work on the railroad and those Teamsters to work in those coal mines, the Commissioner of Natural Resources, at the request of one of the staffers, one of John Cowdery's friends, reneged on the agreement and blew that coal deal. So twice, because this legislation wasn't in effect, we have not developed a coal industry of Alaska that I'm personally aware of. And I've personally seen the contracts on. There's no reason at all that we should spend a penny to subsidize some of the buyer coal. That's another thing entirely to go out of our way to discourage them. And this is a way by which, at no cost to the state, we can have our commissioners negotiate for economic development and promotion of commerce. That's the intent, Mr. Chairman, and I certainly welcome the committee to support my priority bills. I certainly welcome the committee to take this and do what they can to link these together.
Mr. Colby.
Thank you, Chairman. Representative Lindar, you pointed out a very interesting problem here. There isn't anything prohibiting this, but without some sort of legislative backup, we point out two instances where arrangements of this sort, which are legal under current law, nevertheless were not followed through on because of the lack of something. I'm equally worried. I know sometimes hopeless to try to predict what kind of regulations are going to accompany a piece of legislation, but usually, well, when a piece of legislation like this goes through, the department affected will write up regulations. And one of the problems I foresee in trying to interpret it or put their own interpretation on it, is they may give some sort of transferable right, preference right, you know, buy so many gallons of oil or so many tons of coal, you know, buy so many gallons, and then be traded as futures for something that we'll have, in other words, we'll lose control over our own ability to sell our oil freely. Would the same purpose perhaps be adequately, maybe not adequately, at least partially dealt with by a resolution or a joint resolution?
I would have said so, and if I had not had the, if I had not been there, mm-hmm. I was there, mm-hmm. and I heard those negotiations. I've seen the contract. I've got a copy of the contract. And I heard the Commissioner of Natural Resources make that statement, and I know what happened. And the purpose was to prevent the development of the coal industry, and they were quite willing to agree until they suddenly realized that money was changing hands, and that these people were in fact going to develop and put a lot of Teamsters and railroad people to work. And then they reneged. And
which coal field was
it? This was to from the interior coal fields out of Fairbanks. It had to do with 20,000 barrels of residual a day out of the Storo and Chevron refineries in one contract. I have a copy of that contract. I'm not so sure I should show it to you, but I personally have a copy. I'd like the Navy.
Let's go with the question. Just a question of that question.
Yes, I was, you know, since coal is oil, it's required normally to be competitive to bid, whereas coal isn't. And I was wondering, you know, since I don't think we're going to sell any coal in Wyoming or things like this, and I think that the bill is a good idea, but I think it's premature that we can get some of the restrictions on our export of oil. I think that the market that you're primarily interested in is the foreign market for coal.
Not necessarily. And
I don't think that we're going to sell any coal to Wyoming or I don't think it's really a basic shortage of coal in our stateside market. I think we're going to have to, in my opinion, look to the rim or other countries for sale of coal. And since, like I said, oil is normally, our sale of our oil is normally competitively bid, and we get a situation where we mix. Since coal is no in-kind royalties that I know of coal to the state, I'm just wondering if this, even though I think your intent, and I appreciate that, and I'm not trying to be negative, but I'm just wondering if this is to be a situation where would allow a lower price on oil, I'm not quite convinced this is the best way to go with it.
Well, I'd like to respond to that. I would say the same thing if I had not been personally present at some of those negotiations and did not see the contracts and know the individuals. And let me give you a background on this, because there seems to be some misunderstanding about a couple of things. First of all, we have American users of coal and oil who have in the past been expressed a very explicit willingness to buy our coal and oil, a willingness to buy coal if they could simultaneously buy oil. And I will give you an example. Pacific Resources of Honolulu, Hawaii operates coal-powered utility plants and operates the biggest refinery in Hawaii. And they have asked in the past, and they have attempted to buy both coal and oil. They will indicate a willingness to buy coal if they could get oil. And for years ago, the deal was blown because there was no interest in developing in the administration at that time, certainly not this administration, previous administration, in developing jobs in the interior of Alaska on the rail belt. So there is a possibility of tying to America. Secondly, with those who seem to focus on the export of American oil as being impossible, have totally overlooked, which has always astonished me, is the standard practice in the industry of the so-called swaps. A foreign company to this day, for tomorrow, Tokyo Electric or Mitsui or any any of the big Japanese or Korean or Chinese firms could buy our state oil from ARCO or from the state or anybody else right now, and they could buy it instantly, and they could then swap it for delivery. And that's very common in the industry. They might buy 100,000 barrels a day from Valdez and agree that they would give it to Sohio down in, or Texaco or something down in San Diego at their refinery, and for Texaco providing 100,000 barrels a day out of Indonesia. That is a way by which they get oil. Swapping is a common practice to reduce transportation costs. And so much of this discussion about the need to amend the law to prevent the export of Alaskan oil in order to allow the export of Alaskan oil in order to develop our resources is just not so. It's by those who don't understand how the industry operates. It's quite likely that there would be a swap. And for what it's worth, I know of, well, I'm going to say the name of it, I know of a company who was willing again to buy coal if they could have gotten state royalty oil to swap for Indonesian crude. They would have delivered that to the American refiner that wanted it and who wasn't willing to buy coal. They were willing to buy coal and then provide it to the American refiner that wanted it because the American refiner had access to Indonesian crude, which they wanted overseas.
President, let me go to another question here.
Well, just basically when in reading the line here, possibly this question should go to the Attorney General's office or someone, but it seems to me like you had mentioned the interest in the Pacific Rim companies and so on and so forth. Given the fact that we can't sell, I don't understand, we cannot sell royalty oil to the, out of the state of out of the state, let's say, to an international firm.
Absolutely, yes.
We can't.
Absolutely.
There's nothing that
no prohibition whatsoever. They cannot take delivery. They can own it. So Ohio BP is British Petroleum. That is foreign. Country company, you know. They're doing it right now. The lion's share of the oil of Alaska is being sold to foreign companies right now. They are swapping it or using it in their own American refineries.
Thank you. Additional question. One other question. What's the term state coal defined as? Is that just any coal that's produced in the state from anybody?
That's the definition the attorney used to draft it. Additional
question. Representative Winter.
If the sale of oil is tied to the sale of coal, wouldn't they tend to bid lower on the oil and lower their, because they're going to have a lower margin of on the coal?
I think not. I think that you don't want to tie it in the sense you described. I in no way think that the sale of oil should be, the price for oil should be reduced to 1 penny. I would not agree to regulations that reduce that sale price. I would not suggest any wording that would reduce the sale price. What I think we want is the wording that says something like, other things equal, the oil will be sold. Since there is a market price, a going market price, and they tend not to pay more than the market price, and certainly we would let them pay less, we should say something along the lines of, other things equal, those who will buy the most coal should be the ones who buy the oil.
Yeah, but irregardless, Mr. Chairman, of regulations or wording in the Act, wouldn't the tendency be to, for particularly if it was likely that successful bidding would have to depend on the option of taking coal as well, that they wouldn't, as a matter of market conditions, offer less on the oil because they're going to have a less margin on the coal and they'll have to balance that off?
Well, this is already a standard practice here. As I pointed out to you, we already have in practice, in contract right now for our sale to our in-state refiners, the right of the state to buy that residual and use it. That's in their current contract. So we're not changing this practice. It has not been an impediment to date. I noticed that Tesoro just bid 25 cents over the market. Would strongly suggest that the market price has been deliberately understated, since I assume that 25 cents over the posted price is probably in fact the market price.
Additional question for Quincy. Additional question for Representative Lindau. Representative Calgary.
Well, I think the sorrel a year, I think the price was 30 cents. But I point out that Shell offered $1 over a premium. So there's a lot of different things on the premium of our product, but I kind of, I go back to my original statement. I don't think that we're going to be selling coal to South 48. I think with the West Coast Santa Barbara fields coming in, that we're going to need be looking for markets for our resources. I don't think it's oil glut. I think it's not going to, in my opinion, it's going to. Our demand is going to be less, somewhat, than it is now, especially our West Coast. And so I think that the tying the two, although I don't want to sound that I don't want to sell our coal, I want to sell all of our resources, but I'm not convinced that oil, tying the two together would necessarily be an asset to either.
Well, all I can do is look at the past, Mr. Chairman. In the past, not tying it together has cost the state thousands of jobs, cost the development of the tax base, and has been a disaster for us. It's to eliminate our already experience, our bad experiences, and take advantage of opportunities that this should be tied together. It may well be, since this isn't priority legislation, that the committee should look at this. But based on what I personally have observed, and given the fact that our oil revenues are going to run out in the future, and as oil becomes more and more of a scarce commodity in the years ahead and we move into our next shortage area, whether that's in 5 years or 15 or 50 years, tying them together so that the various and sundry administrations, particularly if we get a subsequent administration that is anti-development again, and will make it less likely they can be anti-development, make it less likely that they will be unaware of these opportunities, and since I think these write this as a way to promote development without spending any money, I think this is worthy of very careful work and crafting to put together in such a way that we can give a big boost to our coal industry without in any way doing anything to our oil industry. We have an opportunity here. We got to work on it very carefully and craft it. Pro-development kind of approach.
Let me, before we take additional questions, we do have a couple of people that I'd like to have testimony on, if we could. Are there any additional questions?
I have one additional question. Given the fact that in one sense we're trying to put a limitation on the sense of tying coal to oil in this case, and given the principles of, let's say, the free enterprise system, are we putting an undue burden on the crude oil companies or the oil companies themselves by saying that they're going to get priority by purchasing state coal, when in fact we can let coal stand on its own and we can let oil stand on its own and we can work from that standpoint given the free enterprise principles that we want to ensure in the state of Alaska? And how do you feel about that?
Well, I think that in reality the big users of coal and oil tend to be very huge industrial combines, and they tend to get their product mixed from all over. Both are products in a product mix. And I go back again to Pacific Resources, which was quite willing to buy both. Since the state wouldn't sell it oil, it wouldn't buy coal. It state sold that oil for the very same price that Pacific Resources would have paid for it. It also sold the residual for the very same price that Pacific Resources was willing to pay for it. The only difference between Pacific Resources a few years ago and this other, whoever the other buyers were, is that one of them was willing to buy coal and the other was not. Other things equal, we should have gone with the company that was also willing to pay the full market price for the oil and then also buy coal in order to get it. We made a terrible mistake.
Let's go. If there are no other questions for Representative Linda, I'd like to hear from Mr. Vince O'Reilly, Department of Commerce.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Vincent O'Reilly, Deputy Commissioner of Commerce. And I don't know what set of draft of the bill we're now looking at in light of Representative Lindauer's testimony. Are you using the amended version?
It has not been officially amended, so
okay.
I would take your testimony based upon the addition that he's proposed. Also, if you would.
All right, if I could, Mr. Chairman, with everybody understanding that Representative Lindauer, in his testimony, set up a set of circumstances which may affect the testimony I'm offering. All right, we are, the department is generally in favor of any bill that offers encouragement of development of our natural resources, and we generally support such. We are operating under an administration mandate not to enlarge state subsidies to industry and not to initiate new subsidies. There is a value of some type to either the crude, the refined product, or the coal in this case, which subsidizes the other product. And therefore, we look at this as essentially a bill that introduces a form of subsidy. Now, under some unforeseen circumstances and conditions, the department may favor some type of subsidy. We cannot read into the future that far. What we do at this point, and I'm dealing with the bill as written and presented to us, we oppose the bill because we believe, first, the subsidy, if there is to be such, should be of a fixed, determinable amount. Both sections F and G do not meet this test. Both crude and refined product prices and coal prices are subject to market change. Secondly, the subsidy should be in a medium of value different than the product being subsidized. Crude, refined product, and coal are all energy sources and move in generally parallel market price paths, upward or downward. This could develop into a situation where parallel falling prices could cause the subsidized producer to come back to the state seeking further aid to support an ongoing operation. Thirdly, and in conclusion, it is in the state's interest to optimize the benefits of crude oil and coal production. The two resources do have a price linkage, but are marketed under very different conditions. The subsidy of coal production can be achieved by other means than this option-granting linkage, which could slow down the development of crude.
Mr. Riley, I don't fully follow your subsidy scenario. Could you go through that one more time as to how that takes place?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. There is a value to the obtaining of royalty crude at a fixed price and fixed amount. It removes market uncertainty. And entering into a contract such as that works to the advantage of the purchaser because he knows he's dealing with a guaranteed price and a guaranteed amount. It removes, well, the market uncertainty. So this, in effect, means that we're subsidizing the coal production. But as I try to point out in the testimony, we are in general operating under administration mandate not to increase any present subsidies and certainly not to initiate new ones. But if there is some set of circumstances that necessitates a subsidy, then the medium of value, well, first of all, the subsidy should be of a determinable amount. Entering into contracts where we don't know what the full value of the subsidy is going to be over a period of time has led us into some great difficulty. Secondly, we do believe that the medium value should be different. And crude oil, refined product, and coal generally move in parallel price movements.
Yeah, thank you. Questions?
Why do they move in parallel price increments, as you say?
Because they all come out of, you know, equivalent BTU values, ultimately. It's not an exact movement because crude prices, let's put it the other way around, coal is marketed in a different manner, usually under long-term contracts and certainty of supply and things like that, where crude markets can fall apart and a crude purchaser could depend upon the spot market more than a coal purchaser.
Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
The next question is Attorney Bob Minner from the Department of Law. Bob, you want to join us?
Basically, I don't have any testimony. It was basically available to answer questions that you may have on the present statutory scheme, or maybe some historical memories of what we've been doing in oil and gas over the past number of years. The Department of Law is neutral on.
Are there specific questions to Mr. Maynard concerning this legislation? Bob, for the record, you're going to fight yourself.
My name's Robert Maynard. I'm an Assistant Attorney General, Supervisor of the Oil and Gas Section.
Spelling your last name, please.
M-A-Y-N-A-R-D.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe it's an illegal trade practice for private companies to require or offer tie-in sales. What's the state's status if this offers essentially a sort of tie-in or tag-along? Take A and you get B, kind of thing.
The antitrust problem you're talking about doesn't necessarily, this is not, this gives a preference. This is an additional consideration. It's like asking for a premium or a bonus. The tie-in arrangement that you're concerned about is more where we're attempting to rig the competition in the area. We're trying to get a competitive advantage over other coal companies that we may be competing with or whatever. In this case, I do not see the problem of competition. We're trying to, as I read it, the state coal, so there's no other competition in terms of our own, like Isabella or Beluga or whatever.
That's my question. Is there such an entity as state coal?
There's three ways you could see with that. One is coal that is just mined in the state. The state does have its own coal field, which it has not leased yet. Also, I believe that under the present coal leases, we do have a royalty. We have a royalty interest that we can take, like our oil, in kind or in value. Various combinations of those can be seen as being state coal, where if somebody would buy coal from, say, a private state owner from a state field like Beluga or Isabella, or whoever, that we would give them the preference. One of the problems I would point out in legislation, well, it's not a problem, it's something you have to deal with, is Representative Lindauer talked about all else being equal. It was not clear to me whether all else being equal meant just money, or how you would balance the question of, say, there was another person wanting to build a new state refinery like Doyon did last year, another person willing to pay the end value price and buy coal. I'm not sure whether this legislation would give an absolute preference for the coal or the end state refinery or whatever. The present statutes are confusing as it is, so that's another question. The present contracts we have are with the MAPCO and Coal Refinery, Sorrel, Alaska, and with Chevron. And none of those three have the need for coal. The that Sorrel parent corporation has coal fields. It has in Kentucky, but it's a separate part of the company. They have never shown any desire to get into the question of using coal. Chevron is the same way. They also have coal interest, a large coal interest, but they're such a huge company that one hand is not necessarily tied to the other on the time. We have asked Chevron on various negotiations whether or not they would be interested in developing coal fields, or at some point to give themselves a proposal close to help upgrade the coal. The problem is basically, and Representative Lindauer is correcting this, the prohibition is on physically moving the molecules of oil to a foreign country. There are two primary laws which prevent that. One is the Trans-Alaska Pipeline Authorization Act, as many of you may remember, not in response to the argument for the favor of an Alaska line, but in North Canada. The argument was that the Japan, and they said no, or Congress said no, or both of that. There would not be any sale to a non-contiguous country in the United States, basically allowing for transportation reasons to go to Canada or Mexico. We attempted a three-way swap with Japan and Mexico under that exemption. It didn't work. Section 9. In addition, the Export Act passed and repassed in 79, preventing the disaster. We can, as Representative Lindauer mentioned, the Japanese, if they wish, could buy Alaskan oil, sell it on the West Coast in some sort of swap arrangement. They have not approached the state on that portion. Our understanding is that they feel that that would be, they want the physical oil to come in, because for a lot of psychological applications, because of the idea of getting Alaskan oil into Japan, security of supply in one sense, because they would still have to depend upon some foreign source not being shut off on the backside of the exchange. A third reason is that they feel they still get all the press disadvantages, basically, and none of the advantages. There is the possibility now of selling residual oil to Japan that will only require an export license and does not apply to the restrictions. There is one additional restriction on the sale of oil in our law right now, and that is that we cannot sell oil for sale outside the state unless the commissioner makes a finding that the surplus is present and subjected to intrastate domestic investment needs. So that if there is the possibility of somebody needing it in the state for use as a fine or supply, the commissioner can't sell it for use for use. That's a state law.
Is there anything unconstitutional about the way the bill is written right now? Or a legal problem with it as far as doing
given the problem with a number of additional considerations on state policy over the last few years that don't have money for additional funding. That is an exciting time now. We don't have to mention that in the population that we need. That country is led by the commission to give preference when the Pelicans are saying, I want to see the lending on the fund. State processing, state supply of products, and then other uses. Now, this is say, not only that, but another question is for people who are willing to buy state coal in addition to that. The question is still unanswered, where does that rank in the state processing, state supply, the rank above, in the middle, below, or equal to the other? Right now, they leave that.
Anyone who's
26 is an act of establishing the business refinancing and extension loan program in the Austin Industrial Development Authority in the Audi Corps. We do have a general time sponsor, $1 here. It's a good point to mind at this time. This bill.
I looked over the committee substitute. I thought the committee substitute dealt with all the things, all the problems that brought up the biggest problem which is the total dealt with the committee substitute was the board paid when it comes to the business to have the absolute right. Let's just be the testimony that the chairman takes responsibility. So, if you're listening,
Where do we get Aspro here, or we can continue hearing on this? Yes, sir.
That's the note on the top. There was a question from Mr. Wagman, originally testified that the banks would be dumping all of their bad loans in this program. And there was a question of whether that was statutorily correct, and the drafter said that the provisions of having the bank meet an eligibility, if they gave us so many bad loans, and they would be ineligible to sell us any more loans, was a chapter-wide provision in New Zealand, and they 4488.
Let's entertain testimony from Mr. Dave Rose at this time. Yeah, so it's my understanding here, this is copied, right?
Oh,
but we have his name. No. Let's show it up this morning. Well, I'll get copies made. Mm-hmm.
Good morning.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is David Rose. I'm the executive director of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. Mr. Chairman, generally, let me just state that in reviewing bills such as the committee substitute for House Bill 26, one has to ask a fundamental question as to the problem that we're trying to solve. If the problem we're trying to solve is the availability of money, that's one thing. If the problem we're trying to solve is the cost of money, that's quite another thing. Generally, if there is a problem with the availability of money, that is, money is not available, banks are not awash with funds as they are today, and there is extremis throughout the country, then perhaps it is wise for the state of Alaska to try to see what it can do with its resources to leverage, induce, or otherwise make happen a flow of money to do the things that we wish to do for the state of Alaska. And the Permanent Fund can play a role in trying to induce or leverage the availability of money, the flow of capital into the state to do the things that we wish to do. If, however, and that of course is not the case today, banks are awash with money, and they have been for quite a while, and they will be, I think, for quite a while to come. If, however, the problem that we're trying to solve is the cost of money, i.e., it just costs too much money to do our projects in terms of interest rate, then the proper vehicle for subsidy is in one of two ways. If we wish to subsidize rates, we subsidize either through the sale of tax-exempt bonds, where you have a federal transfer, and then the federal government, of course, picks up the differential through tax exemption versus taxable bonds, or you have an upfront, discernible, identified subsidy, which is passed by legislation and provided so that subsidy is upfront and known, as is the case, for example, with Alaska Housing and Finance Corporation. So generally, I think we have to look at the problem. And the problem today does not seem to be the availability of funds. If the problem today is the cost of funds, and that is the problem that you identify, then the question is, where should subsidy come from if you wish to bring that cost down? Should it come from the federal government in terms of tax-exempt debt? Should it come from the general fund in terms of an upfront appropriation for subsidy? Or should it come from the permanent fund as a hidden subsidy because your rate is lower than market rates? Now, specifically, the bill before us presents some major problems with respect to myself, certainly, as director of the Permanent Fund and to our trustees. And that is that it attempts, to a notwithstanding clause, to obviate the prudent man rule. The prudent man rule basically states that the operators of the fund shall operate and invest in much the same manner as any institutional, prudent institutional investor would invest. What this bill attempts to do, I think, is to say, notwithstanding the prudent man rule, we want you to go ahead and take a look at buying bonds of the Alaska Industrial Development Authority. You must recall that the Alaska Industrial Development Authority issues industrial development bonds, tax-exempt bonds. And there are no circumstances that I can think of in which the Alaska Permanent Fund would buy tax-exempt debt. Since we are yield-oriented and we'll look at the highest potential yield to the minimum risk, we probably will be, and always will be, involved in buying taxable debt.
debt that gives us the highest yield. The Act provides that we shall not buy corporate debt unless it is AA rated debt. Alaska Industrial Development bonds are not AA rated. They're single A rated, and indeed many of the bonds issued by the Alaska Industrial Development Authority are not rated at all. The purchase, potentially, of $1 billion worth of Alaska Industrial Development Authority debt is more debt than can be secured by that organization. And although the Act provides that the Industrial Development Authority will guarantee through full faith and credit the kind of debt issued, the fact of the matter is that the assets of the Alaska Industrial Development Authority are not sufficient to cover major issuance of debt. Additionally, of course, the Alaska Industrial Development Authority, 25% of the fund, $1 billion, does not offer the kind of diversification that the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation would be involved in. We would not put a substantial amount of our assets in one place at one time in a particular sector. I think we can see by example corporations that have done that. Sea Alaska is one, for example, that has come under some tough times because they have invested in fish and in timber at the very time when the fish and timber industries have failed rather dismally. Perhaps a wise investment from Sea Alaska's standpoint in good times, but of course, because they have not diversified, you have seen both industries fail and some real extremists set in. Hopefully that will work out, but it will take a substantial amount of time. The other thing that the bill attempts to do is to provide the issuance of bonds for the program called the Business Refinancing and Expansion Loan Program. Under Section 103 of the Internal Revenue Code, tax-exempt bonds may not be issued for refinancing purposes. And the major reason that Alaska Industrial Development Authority today does not issue tax-exempt bonds, the proceeds of which are used for refinancing, is simply because it is prohibited from doing so by Section 103 of the Internal Revenue Code. So, in conclusion, let me indicate that as director of the Permanent Fund, I would have a fair amount of distress with a bill that, number one, obviates the prudent man a little. Number two, does not provide me the kind of yields that the Permanent Fund should be earning, i.e. taxable yield versus tax-exempt yield. It does not provide me the diversification that I would seek. It does not provide me the liquidity that I would look for in these particular bonds. I have all the authority I now need within my statute to buy taxable bonds from AA-rated corporations, as I do with Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, which issues taxable debt and issues AA-rated debt. Those yields and those securities are very safe, very sound, and we do buy them now, as a matter of fact. We do not need legislation for that. And with respect to ADA, I don't think we need legislation with respect to the empowerment to buy tax-exempt debt. I tremor a little bit at a whole succession of notwithstanding clauses for directed investments. I think you hire the management of the fund to manage, depending on where the markets are and where the rates are. And directed investments, I think, would preclude the opportunities that the fund deserves to take with respect to maximum yield at least risk. I will be pleased to respond to questions.
Are there questions for Mr. Evans? Written memo?
First question I have is, have you, Mr. Rose, had an opportunity to look over the proposed CS that the sponsors furnished?
None of us have.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Malone, only just very briefly, I notice, however, that while there is a cross out of a 10% in Section 1, there is still a shall, which mandates the shall purchase of all of the Alaska Industrial Development Authority bonds, and that would still be obvious. And that's just a quick look.
And on the question of the purchase of the tax-exempt bonds, as I understand the testimony, the bill has two problems. One is that the fund itself would be, the current fund would be buying tax-exempt bonds when it's a tax-exempt institution. That is, it gets no benefit from buying the lower yield bonds, you said. In fact, not at all. It just reduces the yield.
Okay.
And that the other problem you see in the bill is that under the present federal rules for the issuance of tax-exempt bonds, regardless of the question of last return of fund purchase, is that they don't include the financing.
That is correct. The only thing permissible under Section 103 code would be to allow an arm's length party to purchase, but then of course you no longer own it. So refinancing is not permitted under the code.
What, I don't have the statute for me, what is the, is there a, other than the prudent man rule, there are various percentage limitations on the corporation as to what they, how much they can put in any one type of investment, one class of investment right now. What are those runs getting ready to look at the statute?
I have a statute here and I have to look, I believe it's 15%, but, I'm just not sure of the general. I don't know for that. It may be 50%.
I don't know. Thank you.
Okay, additional questions? That's important. What's the pleasure of the committee? Thank you, Mr. Lord. Maybe also. Are there any more witnesses on this legislation? What's the pleasure of the committee at this time?
I think that this bill has some problems.
Is there an objection to the motion?
An amendment.
Objection
to the motion. As amended.
That amendment is still before you.
What a bit.
I have no objection.
Representative Copeland, are we?
No objection.
This has got to be a budget board. If no objections to the motion, so be it. Is there anything else to come before the committee at this time? If not, the meeting is adjourned.